Welcome to another episode of the Deborah Health Report, where we dive into current health and medical topics to keep the Delaware Valley informed and updated. The conversation continues with vascular and endovascular surgeon Dr. Gregory Domer as we discuss vascular disease, including how it's diagnosed, treated, and prevented. Here's Rasa Kay.
Hi, I'm Rasa Kay, and we continue our fantastic voyage through the vascular system with Deborah Vascular and Endovascular Surgeon Dr. Gregory Domer. We've got more on vascular health and a detailed look at aneurysms, when the wall of an artery weakens and bulges and even breaks, and how to figure out your risk. We begin this segment with how Dr. Domer and his team figure out whether a blockage in a leg artery should be surgically repaired or simply managed.
That is extremely important. Many people will say, well, I have a blockage. And some people will say, you know, I can walk 2 miles, but I get pain in my leg. I like to walk 2 miles because I've been doing it for several years, but now I can't do it. I wouldn't treat that lesion. And I think most vascular surgeons would not treat that lesion because we know that if we treat claudicants, the risk is at least 4 times higher that we will then put them at some point into critical limb ischemia. And the amputation rate can be up to 9 times higher than in those patients, because developing that critical limb ischemia, then sometimes doing the intervention, we then have now lost our opportunities for adequate revascularization procedures, if they ever even progress to the point where they have disabling claudication. So that's an important piece. And I mentioned earlier that I spend about 80% of my time convincing people that they don't need an intervention, because we could end up making them much worse off than, you know, having some pain when they walk a mile or 2 miles. And that reassuring them that the pain that they're getting is not like having chest pain. That is something that needs to be emergently worked up and looked into. Pain in the legs when they walk, if it's tremendous pain and numbness and you have inability to move your foot or your toes, that's something clearly different. That is a limb-threatening problem. But the person that's just having some pain with ambulation does not need any kind of emergent intervention.
Let's talk about aneurysms. How do you have any clue there might be one going on? That's a bulge someplace, correct? That's stress on a blood vessel, on a big one somewhere in the body, correct? Where might that happen?
So the most common location of aneurysmal disease is in the abdominal aorta. So I typically tell people it's right behind their belly button. Most people, the vast majority of people, are completely asymptomatic, would never know they even have an aneurysm. So the only way to find out you have an aneurysm is to have some kind of imaging, unless they've ruptured and now it's a surgical emergency. And it's not a surgical emergency anybody wants to be involved with, because the mortality rate is so high. And sort of the surgical dogma is that 50% of the people that have a ruptured aneurysm will not survive. And 50% don't make it to the hospital, and of the 50% that do make it to the hospital, 50% of them will die. So the mortality for aneurysmal rupture is extremely high. It's loss of blood. So again, this artery is the size of a garden hose, and if it were to rupture, it's carrying 5 liters per minute of blood flow. So a tremendous volume under significant pressure. And so if that artery ruptures, people, yeah, they essentially exsanguinate into their abdominal cavity. And that's why it's so essential to repair it before that happens. And oftentimes patients will come to us because they've maybe gone to an orthopedic surgeon or sometimes a chiropractor, and they've had some sort of imaging on their spine and an aneurysm is picked up. And that's probably the most common reason that we see aneurysmal disease in our office. But there is also now more awareness of aneurysmal disease. So there are several high-profile people that have died of aneurysmal disease. The most important, the most prominent, probably Albert Einstein, died of a ruptured aneurysm. He had it fixed once, but that was without the techniques that we have today. So it never got rid of his pain. He died a miserable life approximately 5 years after. They actually wrapped it in cellophane, thinking that it would cause an intense inflammatory response, which it did, but that certainly isn't going to seal that aneurysm or prevent it from future rupture. It just created the next 5 years of his life in misery.
So the repair techniques now, we've advanced from cellophane.
Yes, we've made tremendous advances, and that's one of the areas in vascular surgery that is there has been tremendous evolution, and there still is. The vast majority of aneurysms are relatively straightforward, and most people go home the next day after intervention for their aneurysm, and it's done through very small incisions, about a quarter of an inch in each groin. Compared to when I trained, it would require an incision from your xiphoid, which is your breastbone, down to your pubic bone, and a hospital stay of 4 to 7 days. Now people are going home the next day and little to minimal recovery, where before it was 6 weeks to 3 months of recovery because it was a big operation. We still do need to do that operation, and believe it or not, as everything in life, the pendulum swings. So we were performing a lot more of these, they're called endovascular aneurysm repairs, but now we've started to see, now that we've been doing them for over 25 years, we're starting to see some failure of those aneurysm repairs with the endovascular method. So now we're going back to doing more of these aneurysms open, the traditional way, and that's typically in younger people, because as time goes on, these aneurysm repairs can fail for a variety of reasons. So again, it's extremely important that we're providing intervention on the appropriate people. So just the presence of an aneurysm is not the indication to perform an aneurysm repair.
Would there be a watch and wait scenario in any of these cases?
I probably am monitoring well over 500 or 800 aneurysms in a surveillance program, meaning that we're just doing ultrasounds, sometimes CAT scans, looking at the aneurysm, checking to see if there's growth. If there's no growth and it's stable and it's within the guidelines that we can continue to monitor, then we continue to monitor. And the vast majority of those people, we will never operate on. In fact, I tell people that, you know, we're watching several hundred people with aneurysms, but only end up operating on maybe 40 or 50 of those per year, because the vast majority of them just sort of stabilize. So until the aneurysm reaches a specific size, or if there's rapid growth of the aneurysm, then there's less risk of it rupturing than us doing a procedure and having a major complication.
When you're doing this, the monitoring, are there symptoms that you have to worry about?
So there are, but I spend a lot of time, you know, reassuring people that this is one of your disease pathologies that you have, just like you have hypertension, or maybe you have coronary artery disease. Whatever the disease processes you have, this is one of them. Because people will always say, but doc, I feel like I have a ticking time bomb in
my belly. I would think that people feel like it's a waiting game, and that, yeah, you kind of have to do a lot of hand-holding on living with this.
Right.
But this is more of a monitoring than a management.
Yeah, and again, because, so if you have type 1 diabetes and you're on insulin, your mortality rate from having a major complication and dying of a diabetes-related disease is higher than the aneurysm rupturing, assuming that it's within the appropriate guidelines of continued monitoring. So that's what I try to get across to people. If it's under 5 centimeters, there's less than a 1% chance that it's going to rupture. And if we do an intervention, there's greater than a 1%, a 1 to 2% chance of having a major complication. So we do an awful lot of aneurysm repairs here, so our rates are a little bit better than that. But still, the risk of just continuing surveillance on a small aneurysm, the risk of it rupturing is very, very low.
Should you stumble upon an aneurysm, that person should consider themselves lucky.
Yes, yes. Because the symptoms that you mentioned are typically intense abdominal pain that radiates to the back, sometimes to the groins. And the vast majority of the times when people have symptoms of a ruptured aneurysm, or a symptomatic aneurysm, let's say, it's ruptured. So it's unusual that we just get people that just have some pain from their aneurysm. We do. We see a few a year where they're just having pain, and it's probably because the aneurysm is stretching out, and there are nerve fibers there that cause some pain and some tenderness when we palpate that aneurysm. And so we'll repair those even if they aren't at the size criteria. But the vast majority of people that become symptomatic, it's because they've ruptured. And so that becomes a surgical emergency. And so what I tell people is, you know, if you have some indigestion and you have a little bit of abdominal discomfort, you know, don't be concerned it's your aneurysm, because the pain you're going to have from a ruptured aneurysm is going to get your attention. It's not something that's going to be subtle. It's going to be probably the worst pain you've ever had, and it's not going to relent. It's going to persist. And so if you have that kind of pain, you need to come to the emergency department. There is now screening protocols that have been put into place, and that is males over the age of 65 that have a smoking history should all be screened for aneurysmal disease.
Even if it was in their distant past?
Actually, the definition is 100 cigarettes or more in their lifetime. So yes, it can be any time. So those people should all be screened. Or people that have a family history of aneurysmal disease, the evidence isn't quite as strong for that, but still, I would advise any of my patients, and in fact do, if a patient comes to me with an aneurysm, I tell them to notify all of their first-degree relatives, so their parents, brothers or sisters, and children, once they reach the age of 60 to 65, should undergo a screening ultrasound to ensure that they don't have an aneurysm, because there is a 15% chance that there is going to be another first-degree relative. There is a genetic predisposition to aneurysmal disease, so all of those patients should then be screened as well.
Now, this is men and women?
Men and women. It's more prominent in men, much more prominent in men. However, the issue with women is their aneurysms rupture at a smaller size, so there's actually an increased incidence of ruptured aneurysms in females, oftentimes because they're not picked up and they rupture at a smaller size.
So how do we prevent this? Is there a point where you can reverse any of this?
So unfortunately, vascular disease is not completely preventable. We can do risk factor modification and medical management, which can slow the progression and sometimes cease the progression, but we can never completely stop it. And nothing in vascular surgery is ever 100%. So when we're revascularizing people, none of these bypasses or interventions that we do are 100%. So that's why we have to have a very good reason in the first place to even be doing it. But medical management and risk management is the number one. So smoking is the number one risk factor that's modifiable. So I even tell patients that, you know, before we do any kind of revascularization procedure, you have to commit to me that you are going to quit smoking. Because smoking is like pouring gasoline on a fire. It just exacerbates profoundly the plaque progression that occurs. And after an operation, a significant inflammatory response now occurs. So smoking on top of that will significantly decrease the success rate of that operation, whatever it may be. And diabetes also. So, you know, that's also a modifiable to make sure that their HbA1c is checked by their primary care physicians and that it's monitored and that they're taking their medications, controlling their hypertension. So all of those things are modifiable. Also, that if we see somebody that has peripheral artery disease, that they initiate a walking exercise program, whether it be coming into a supervised walking exercise program or whether they just do it on their own. And we usually tell people to, you know, 7,500 to 10,000 steps a day. Everybody now has an app on their phone where they can sort of keep track of that. And that will change people's lives if they're able to control the modifiable risk factors and initiate a walking exercise program. They will dramatically decrease the likelihood of them ever requiring any kind of surgical intervention.
When should somebody come see a vascular specialist?
There are screening protocols for when people should be tested for PAD, and that includes people over the age of 65 or people younger that, of course, anybody symptomatic, so having pain when they walk. But people with diabetes, hypertension, dyslipidemia, smokers, those people probably should be screened a little bit earlier. Simple test can be done. It's called an ABI, and it's just a pressure measurement that compares the upper extremity to the lower extremity. And we use the upper extremity as the control because it's very unlikely that you will ever develop any significant atherosclerotic disease in your upper extremities. So we use that as the control, compare it to the pressure at your ankle, and if there's a significant difference, then that essentially is a diagnosis of peripheral artery disease. Again, most of those people don't need anything done, but then a discussion needs to be held with that patient about modifiable risk factors and whether to initiate medical therapy. And we leave that component typically up to the primary care physicians. But if patients are symptomatic, then that's when they send those patients to us and we talk further about, you know, modifiable risk factors and initiating a walking exercise program and basically just get across to them how serious this can potentially be and the importance of participating in this program.
How do we keep our arteries and our veins as healthy as possible? Again, quit the smoking,
yeah.
But is there like an artery strengthening diet?
A heart healthy diet.
Yeah.
So, you know, everybody knows heart-healthy diets today, right? Fruits and vegetables, decrease the amount of red meats. You know, the craze today is a vegan diet or, you know, a non-meat-based protein diet. So any of those things are heart-healthy. They're also good for your blood vessels.
New treatments for treating vascular disease?
So there are new treatments. Vascular surgery is one of the most dynamic fields in medicine. I think that's what draws a lot of us to the field. So the practice of vascular surgery, and when I say the practice of vascular surgery, now I'm talking about the interventions that we do.
The Roto-Rooter part of it.
The Roto-Rooter part of it is very different from when I finished my training over 20 years ago. So it's constantly evolving, and there are new techniques and new technologies coming out all the time, and most of them less invasive. So it used to be we would have a service full of patients that we had done peripheral bypasses on, which can be a morbid procedure in that patients are typically in the hospital for several days. We still do bypasses, and bypasses are still an excellent part of our armamentarium, but now we're able to do percutaneous procedures. Just through a needle stick, we're able to revascularize somebody's lower extremity or perhaps the arteries to their intestines or their kidneys, or even to the carotid vessels in their brain. But by and large, vascular intervention is constantly evolving and changing and evolving.
That's vascular and endovascular surgeon Dr. Gregory Domer. In our next segment, we'll examine another health issue you'll want to understand for your own health or that of a loved one. As always, it drops the first Wednesday of the month. I'm Rasa Kay.
You can always listen to all of the informative Deborah Doctor interviews at DeborahHealthReport.com. Schedule an appointment at demanddeborah.org.